So, my talk's called Heaven and Hell. Well, in fact, it's not called that. It's called Beyond Heaven and Hell. So that's a good start. So, those of you who've been coming to this class recently, at least in the last 5 weeks, will have heard a number of talks on the worldly winds, the 8 worldly winds of life. But for those of you who haven't been here, these are 4 pairs of opposite experiences which we experience time and time again. So they are pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, and what I'm calling good reputation and disgrace. Sometimes it's called fame. And we swing between each of these pairs, maybe ricocheting back and forth. Sometimes they play havoc with our lives. And as each of the winds gives way to its opposite, we see that they're really two sides of the same coin. The difficulty, of course, quite obviously, is that we're usually attached to the pleasant side of the pair and want to avoid the unpleasant side. So these winds assail us because we're subject to the 3 marks of conditioned life. So that is suffering, impermanence and insubstantiality. So we long for happiness, don't we? We long for things to be permanent and solid in a world that only offers these things fleetingly. So these winds get under our skin. Common sense knows all about them. If some crisis occurs when we're hoping for a quiet day, we go, oh well, that's life. Or with a shrug we say, yeah, you win some, you lose some, that kind of thing. So we know there's no pleasing everybody. We know about them, don't we? And yet still they keep us in their grip, don't they? Because we just enjoy the pleasant ones and we don't enjoy the unpleasant. And yet there's no escaping them. Even if we were in a cave meditating all alone, far away, if we even had this tiny thought, I wonder if the locals admire me, then we'd be caught in one of those winds. So the first step is to notice, as with almost everything in Buddhism, the first step is to notice. So we observe how our experience fluctuates with the ups and downs of life. We're buffeted around. There's a project that I read about in the US, which is a huge biosphere. I think it's a bit like the Eden Project. And it's got many acres covered over with glass, creating different microclimates inside. And in the savanna section, there are huge trees. But these have had to be held up by guy ropes because there's no wind. According to tree specialists, it's because it's enclosed and the trees need wind. They need that resistance to keep them upright. It strengthens them, in fact. And without it, they sag and they droop and their sap doesn't rise. So I thought this was quite a good metaphor for life. Somehow I found it a bit encouraging. So we can value the struggle. The buffeting of life helps our energies to flow, our sap to rise, and helps us become more robust. So if we respond to these winds creatively, they can definitely support our awakening. The American Buddhist scholar and activist Joanna Macy, who I expect some of you will have read, she says, "In my experience, the world itself has a role to play in our awakening up, in our liberation. Its very pressures, pains and risks wake us up. They release us from the bonds of ego and guide us home to our vast true nature." So these worldly winds, they're unavoidable, beyond our control, but we aren't helpless in the face of them. I think that's an important, encouraging thing. We aren't helpless in the face of them. They're an opportunity. Practicing the Buddha's middle way asks us to see clearly the difference between control on the one hand and influence. We can influence our lives. We have choice about how we respond to these things. And what we choose will influence and shape our experience. We know this, don't we? Our minds create our world. On retreat recently, somebody asked the team, what in all the years that you've been meditating has been your greatest obstacle? And my friend replied simply, my mind. I thought it was a great answer, so I didn't add anything. However, later I heard two of the retreatants speculating whether there might be something wrong with him mentally. Which reminds me that it's not evident, at least when we first start meditating, it's not evident that our minds are what cause most of our trouble, as well as our joys. So the first pair, gain and loss, concern material gain, worldly success, and that experience of possessing or acquiring things, as if we can sort of add them on to ourselves, or even we try to do this with people sometimes. So it concerns all of that. And of course, we don't always get what we want, and then we experience a sense of lack. We're eager to protect what we've gained already, and then we'll inevitably lose that. So it's about beginnings and endings, you could say. So we experience gain and loss all the time in little ways. And they test our sense of security sometimes. Even if we do get what we want, we rarely maintain that pleasurable feeling of gain. Because the novelty wears off, doesn't it? The new object, the new piece of clothing, that great new idea starts to seem ordinary and we take it for granted. So we don't have that sort of delighted sense of gain anymore. And so we feel a sense of lack again, and so it goes. And we want to repeat the cycle with a new object. This is the basis of consumerism, I'm sure you've noticed. So there's a story of a Chinese farmer whose wife has a baby boy. The neighbours turn up to rejoice. How fantastic! And the farmer calmly says, well, maybe so. Later, when the boy's growing up, he's unexpectedly given a horse. Again, the neighbours turn up to say, hey, what luck, fantastic. And the farmer replies, well, maybe so. Then the son has a riding accident and he injures his back. The neighbours come round yet again and say, oh dear, how terrible. And the farmer says, well, maybe so. And then soon war breaks out and all the young men are being called up by the army. The neighbours arrive again, saying, oh no, how dreadful, your son's going to have to go to war. And the farmer says, well, maybe so. Then it turns out his back injury makes him unfit for the army. And the neighbours turn up again. And so it goes. So the level-headed farmer keeps his feet on the ground while the winds of loss and gain are blowing. He isn't rocked by the twists and turns of fortune. So in a sense, he's in charge of his own mind and therefore his life. I'd say he sounds a little bit dour, actually. I'd want to enjoy the good fortune when it comes, but just keeping that thread of realism, keeping that sense of realistic feet on the ground. There's a concise modern version of things going well for a while and then going awry, which seems especially prevalent, I think, with technology. After a hard day with computer difficulties, one friend of mine wrote this haiku. Yesterday it worked. Today it's not working. Samsara is like that. So staying level-headed with smaller setbacks can prepare us for the big losses, like bereavement. We need to set our expectations in line with reality. We're all mortal. We'll all grow old, get sick, die, of course. Facing the inevitability of loss with grace and not fighting it. So the second pair, fame and disgrace, concerns status. So fame here includes success, good reputation, popularity, which is a big deal for most of us. So nobody enjoys fame and good reputation all the time. Even if you're positive and friendly, you can attract antagonism from people because they're envious or competitive. What one person appreciates in you, other people might dislike. So we might strive to gain a certain status, be famous in our field, whatever, but it's all very fleeting. We know this. Fashions change, or we can't keep up the effort to stay on top. The only remedy is to develop our inner resources, so our well-being doesn't depend on other people's liking or approval. So we can also, I think, notice if we're unskillful or in some ways compromise our integrity in order to be popular. This can be quite subtle, I think. If, for instance, we don't speak out in case we're not liked, then we're caught in this worldly wind, I think. This summer I heard Aung San Suu Kyi, the Burmese opposition leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner. She was giving two of this year's Reith lectures. Most of you probably know she's been under house arrest, imprisoned, separated from family, and depressed in various really grim ways for 22 years, until a few months ago. And she's certainly felt these worldly winds keenly. She's been hailed as a heroine, and she's been reviled. She's experienced terrible loss and deprivation, but determined not to be crushed by these fluctuating circumstances. And I was really amazed when she said that she's always felt free inside, even under house arrest for all those years. So in captivity, she kept herself informed, and she continued her non-violent campaign. And crucially, I think, she maintained perspective. No sense of self-pity here. For instance, that she's fared better, much better than many of her Burmese fellows, some of which are no longer alive. So a really creative response, I think, to these unpredictable winds. The third pair, praise and blame, applies particularly to speech. So praise here includes applause, approval, appreciation. And blame includes criticism, ridicule, or even abuse. So indeed, fame and unpopularity, praise and blame, both of those pairs, they challenge our sense of self-worth, self-esteem, don't they? Because we won't experience praise continually. After all, no unenlightened beings are perfect, and nor are other people's praise. As with the other pairs, difficulties arise when we either take too much to heart, we take them as a judgment, or we let them affect our self-esteem in one way or another. So the Buddha urges us to expect blame. In the Dhammapada, he says, there's always blame. If you say too much, some people will blame you. If you say just a little, some people will blame you. If you say nothing at all, some people will blame you. It's inevitable. However, with all these winds, it's important to seek out the truth. Examining our thoughts and testing our interpretations is hugely helpful. So we need to be clear, was I unskillful there? Or was I just uncomfortable or pained at being blamed? So honest investigation helps us to take it much more lightly, doesn't it? If there's truth in it, try and make amends. And if there's no truth in it, why worry? I notice how quick I am to question the blame, whereas with compliments, I'm quite happy to accept them as true. But we might ask, is it true? Following Byron Katie, for those of you who might know her work, I would then ask, can I be absolutely sure that it's true? And this second question, if we really pause to reflect on it, frequently the answer changes. That's what I've noticed. If you give it a few minutes, frequently it changes. So, how to respond creatively to praise and criticism? This often arises with feedback I get for the trainings I run. Of course, like everyone, I prefer the praise, but I do try and question both. Was it fair comment? What can I learn? As I lead many courses and retreats, I have quite a visible role, and then these winds seem to blow even more keenly or sharply. But one benefit is that it does help develop robustness. And by this I mean the ability to stay positive under fire, respond openly to challenging questions, at least on a good day, and in testing conditions. The Dhammapada also says, As a solid rock cannot be moved by the wind, the wise are not shaken by praise or blame. They don't speak vain words, and they're the same in good fortune or in bad. So the Buddha himself received quite a lot of abuse and criticism. In fact, his whole order was slandered. But he urged his disciples to endure it with fortitude. He said that slander lasts 7 days, and so does praise. That's very particular, isn't it? 7 days. But it also helps to bear in mind the law of karma. We can have faith that positive actions will bring positive results, even if we can't see it immediately, which we often can't. So if someone praises us, we're probably glad, let's face it. But we might also feel proud. We could instead feel grateful, pleased that we've contributed to them, in whatever way. We could even dedicate the benefits of our actions to all beings. That would be a good day, wouldn't it? However, such positive responses would move us away from self-concern, that kind of tight knot, and towards connection. If we're criticised, instead of getting defensive or feeling dejected, we might feel regret, perhaps apologising if suitable, or if we weren't to blame, looking for a way to understand what's up for that person. An optimistic aspect of the Buddha's teaching, I always reckon, is that we're bound to be unskillful. It's inevitable. But even then, all is not lost. If we recognise our unskillfulness, well, that shows we're aware, and then we can move into some sense of gratitude, remorse, confession, honest communication, all of which are very connecting, expansive states. And as such, they're closer to reality, or so we hear. So as Satchalila said, I work as a trainer in nonviolent communication, and this has a subtle take on praise and blame. Praise says much more about the speaker than it does about the person being blamed. It tells us that the person feels pain of some sort due to some important values not being satisfied. So if I can listen out for and try and understand those values, then it's relatively easy not to take it personally. I'm not the cause of someone else's feelings. The cause lies within them. And if you follow this process with practice, you'll never hear judgment or blame again. How about that for an advert? Never hear judgment or blame again. Going a step further, Marshall Rosenberg, who founded this process, says, when we blame others, we give up the power to change ourselves. When we blame others, we give up the power to change ourselves. And we give up that power because we're telling ourselves that other people are the cause of our distress. And therefore, we're victims of their behaviour. We're not free anymore. When we're blaming others, we're out of touch with what matters to us in that moment. So rather than being stuck in what I call black and white thinking, with awareness, we can move to understanding ourselves more deeply and learning what we need to bring us alive. So I might, for instance, say be judging a politician if I was saying something like, well, they're a complete fraud. If I'm in touch with what matters to me, I'd be focusing on how much I want honesty and integrity in those that are running the country. I'm guessing that might be under calling someone a fraud in this case. And if I'm focusing on those values rather than the judgment, something in my mental state loosens and I feel better, I feel more empowered. And actually it's more true. When it comes to praise, I now see that labelling people and pronouncing what they are is actually very unhelpful. So comments like, you're brilliant, you're a star, are actually unhelpful because they fix people. And they assume that we, the speaker, know who they are. We know what they are. It's a bit like playing God. So some people enjoy compliments, probably most of us, and verbal rewards, but not everybody, actually, I've discovered. Other people feel quite uncomfortable with them. They feel some sort of pressure or some sort of expectation. And after all, many of us have been manipulated by insincere praise. for example, managers praising workers in order to get them to work harder. So a skillful way to give appreciative feedback is to tell people concretely what they've actually done, what they did that we liked, and how it affected us, what values were met for me. So, for instance, rather than saying, "You're so clever," I could say, "Well, when you explained that document to me, I felt really relieved and actually feel so much clearer now. Thanks a lot." So you've said something very clear and tangible, but it's factual as well, because I'm talking about my experience. I'm not talking about them. And it leaves them much freer, of course. They know what they can do again. If you tell them they're a star, they don't know what they can do again to be supportive. And it's clean somehow. There's no strings attached. Moving on to the fourth pair, pleasure and pain. Pain refers to physical and mental pain, dissatisfaction, sorrow, stress, all of that. And we respond with these feelings, pleasure and pain, to all of the above three pairs. Everyone wants to be happy, more or less, and to avoid pain. But we don't always see that happiness isn't something we can pursue. It's a byproduct of satisfying relationships and a meaningful life. Positivity, on the other hand, is something we can develop, something we can pursue. It is within our own control. We can be positive in the face of disaster or chaos. But if our positivity depends on things going right, then our happiness will be very fragile, won't it? Because so many conditions would need to be in place to keep us happy. Sometimes just one thing changing can bring us unhappiness, like an unpleasant meal or rain when we wanted sun. So we can reflect, to what extent does my happiness depend on external conditions? To what extent does it depend on things going right? So Buddhism begins by acknowledging pain. We can't escape physical suffering. But we suffer as much, if not more, by our response to physical pain. The Buddha famously likened suffering to being pierced by an arrow. This could be anything, from a stubbed toe to the loss of a loved one or a serious illness, whatever. So we may or may not be able to change that. But what we often do is to throw a second arrow at ourselves by being angry or resistant or denying the pain of the first arrow. So somehow fighting the experience, which of course doubles our suffering. So one way of describing the Buddha's path is the middle way beyond this grip of pain and pleasure. I'm sure plenty of you have heard about this. But as we grow spiritually, we'll continue to experience pain and pleasure, of course we will. But we do become less and less attached to them if we try. Before he was enlightened, the Buddha's own journey constituted a series of challenges with this pair, pleasure and pain. So he overcame pleasure when he gave up his princely life and his family. And he overcame the desire to please others as well by choosing his own path. And then he conquered comfort by taking up this tough, homeless life for a while. Then he overcame the pain of isolation when he saw that there was nobody in the land that could teach him. No one knew more than him. And then he overcame resistance to pain when he followed those very severe ascetic practices, almost starving himself to death. And then he overcame his attachment to that painful method and he gave it up, seeing it didn't lead to freedom. And then he remembered the famous incident, I'm sure you all know about, when he had a blissful experience as a boy under the rose apple tree. And he said to himself, "Why do I fear the pleasure that meditation can bring?" And he realized that contented pleasure wasn't the same as the desire that clouds awareness. It had a different flavor. And in this way, he overcame a subtle fear of pleasure, of the wholesome pleasure that comes from meditation and awareness. So finally he conquered pleasure and pain when he was unmoved, sitting under the Bodhi tree, he was unmoved by Mara's seductive daughters and Mara's fearsome armies. So yeah, he battled with this pair, pain and pleasure, right up to the point of freedom. So we will expect to be grappling with this for a long time. And I think the impulse behind looking for pleasure and avoiding pain is so strong in us that it almost seems impossible to change. It isn't. I wouldn't be standing here saying this if it was, but it can seem it. Sometimes I have a look and I go, oh my God, it's almost so immediate, so ingrained. But if our happiness depends on avoiding pain and grasping pleasure, we're just going to be victims because our strategy just can't succeed, can it? We know that, we've seen that, I'm sure most of us have seen that. And we're victims because we're denying the facts of life and not accepting that you can't always get what you want. However, all is not lost. Simply by having a human body, well, we're beset by these winds, by having a human body, but it's also, tradition says that it's a very precious thing to be human. Partly because of our awareness, we're aware of being aware as human beings. And partly precisely because of pain and pleasure, funnily enough, because the very mix of pain and pleasure is fruitful for spiritual growth, or so we hear. Because the pain wakes us up, it prompts us to look deeper, not be complacent, and the pleasure draws us on, it keeps us buoyant, we don't get too miserable. So just having that mix is actually very helpful. If we can stay open to the sunshine and the rain of life, we can experience the beauty of both, perhaps even find rainbows in our heart from time to time. So we all have our strategies for dealing with these winds. I'm sure you've all got your pet behaviours that seem to work. So some people choose not to put their head above the parapet. If you don't stand out, you won't get criticised or blamed. Others choose pessimism or having low expectations, thinking that, well, the good fortune will soon run out and I don't want to have dashed hopes. This could seem quite pragmatic. But we're still caught in the wind because it's a strategy to avoid pain, isn't it? So get to know your particular strategies. What's your little way in? Our mind's always looking for loopholes, isn't it? So where are you thinking, oh yeah, I'm gonna get over this one? There's a popular Tibetan image known as the Wheel of Life. I'm sure most of you know it. And according to Sangharakshita, the Wheel of Life is a mirror in which we see ourselves. So it's a graphic illustration of how our minds work, indeed how our world is. So in terms of these winds, I just want to focus on one, I think, rather overlooked part, which is there's a half black and half white ring round the hub, round the centre. Not quite at the centre, but just around the centre. And in the white band, you see people ascending, as it were, looking happy and contented. And in the black part, coming down, you see naked beings tumbling downwards, looking tormented. So it seems to be saying you have two alternatives, to go up or go down. And broadly, the Buddhist view is that life includes enjoyment and dissatisfaction, and each passes into the other. These days you might say, one minute we're over the moon, next minute you're sick as a parrot. So I think these black and white bands symbolise innocence in the sense of naive optimism and despair. And both innocence and despair, they kind of need to meet life and be matured by it. They need to meet experience, be more aware of the realities of life, you might say. And to tread the middle way, the Buddha's path, means relaxing around these highs and lows, not getting so involved in the whether you're going up or whether you're going down. Pleasure and pain also are fleeting feelings. They don't tell us much information. I get much more understanding if I'm clear what's beneath any feeling on any given minute. And then I can take responsibility for that. Earlier on, I said that the cause of our feelings lies within us. Feelings aren't caused by other people. So if, for example, I was sitting in a cafe and the person I'm meeting is half an hour late, so a certain sort of person with a particular temperament, they might feel annoyed or frustrated as the minutes pass. They're wanting to use their time well. And they've got a need for consideration. Perhaps they value reliability. So that's person A. Person B, in the same situation in the cafe, whose friend's 30 minutes late, well, this person might be sad or upset, feeling insecure maybe, wondering if their friend cares about them, doesn't care enough to turn up on time. So they've got a need for care, reassurance, or concern for their friendship. So there's a third type of person, or it could be the same person in a different mood. So their friend's 30 minutes late also, but this person, she's enjoying the cafe. She's had a cappuccino, she's read the paper, she's relaxed, she's caught up on her texting, and all is well. Her needs for ease are well and truly met. So you see, there's the same stimulus, the other person being half an hour late, but quite different feelings and quite different underlying values, concerns and needs. So yes, other people's actions, they do stimulate us in certain ways, feelings will arise, but we need to understand and I think really take responsibility for our own responses. And this kind of reflection has helped me so much with these wins. It's not just about whether I feel pleasure or pain, but what else is there? There's more to it than that. According to the Theravadan nun, Ayakema, she says, we constantly search for what seems favourable and flinch from adversity. And because everybody does the same, there's no peace in the world. Only when we accept that these opposite pairs give rise to each other can we live a balanced life. Whatever we get hold of, money, love, another person, a joyful event, it'll pass. We need to keep looking impermanence in the eye and realizing how short our time on earth is, how insignificant we are compared to the whole universe. So with this perspective, the eight worldly winds no longer have power over us. So I think we also, as well as taking responsibility for what's ours, as it were, we also need mindfulness. I'm sure I haven't heard the other talks in this series, but I imagine everybody would have said that. We need mindfulness. We need to find the point of freedom between having those feelings and reacting to them. If we can feel our feelings without leaning towards or pushing away, we can move from habitual behaviour to something much more creative. So mindfulness, by its nature, is balanced. It's a mirror that doesn't judge what it reflects. It isn't for or against anything. And being mindful makes us more centred and, again, more robust in the face of these winds. There's also another kind of awareness that helps, which is called apramada, or heedfulness. Not really a word we often use, heedfulness. But what it really means is when we take heed, we see the context squarely. We have an ethical perspective. We're aware of the consequences of our actions. So mindfulness and heedfulness are vital with these winds. But best of all is equanimity. So the Buddha urged us to cultivate loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. These are the positive emotions that strengthen our hearts. But equanimity, which I can hardly say, but it's a beautiful thing, is warm, serene, and contained. You could say it's emotional freedom itself. and it makes us broad enough to withstand whatever life throws at us. I was writing this talk the day after I'd been on a panel of an interfaith meeting about peace, which was organised by the Somerset Quakers. So I gave a talk on peace from a Buddhist perspective, and there was Q&A afterwards, along with the other three speakers. My talk seemed to go down well, but I was cringing about the missed opportunity to reveal Buddhism's distinct angle during the questions around the Bible. I wanted to show that Buddhist non-violence is not over-idealistic, as the Anglican vicar seemed to be implying. So afterwards, I spent time teasing apart two aspects of my post-panel cringe. So there was the part that wanted to be clear about the Dharma, wanted to do justice to Buddhism. And there was another part that wanted to be seen in a favourable light. It wanted praise. The first part felt quite clean, not unethical. And the second part felt sticky and personal, although understandable. So there I was, writing this talk on the sofa, and all the while I was trying to avoid the discomfort in my chest about how I was received the night before. Sort of calling my own bluff, really. Here were the wins, quite obviously, at least a couple of the pairs, and could I do as I was suggesting here in this talk? Can I affirm myself rather than looking outside for praise? Of course I can. And I often do, but it takes work. And I was feeling reluctant, didn't want to do it. Much easier to look outside myself, hope for an appreciative email. So to put it poetically, I needed to touch the earth, as the Buddha just did before his awakening. So this gesture, the earth-touching gesture, no, he's not making it there, but I'm sure you've all seen Buddhas doing this. This gesture is about standing on our own experience, calling up faith and confidence in ourselves, not looking for others to rescue us. So I knew I needed to apply both reason and emotion with these winds. So reason asked me to assess rigorously, did I say anything I was ashamed of? Did I stand behind the points I'd made in my talk? And my answers to the Q&A. And actually the answer was yes, pretty much. So exploring my emotions then, I coaxed myself to fully sense the feelings, which pretty much boiled down to feeling exposed and disappointed, and their underlying cause. So with unpleasant feelings, we can either have the feelings and move up into our head and start judging and blaming. Got a painful feeling and I want to say that it was that vicar's fault or whoever it was, you know, it was that person who asked the stupid question. So I could go up and do that, do the judging and blaming, or, and this is what I was trying to do, we can move deeper into our experience, feel the feelings and try and contact the unaddressed values underneath. So below my cringe and disappointment lay a wish for affirmation and acceptance. So I stayed with that longing for affirmation and acceptance. And this self-empathy allows feelings to shift. I can do it alone. I often do. So soon, some minutes, more self-acceptance did emerge, and the ache in my chest subsided. So we all enjoy appreciation and recognition of our efforts. However, there are some inner longings, like for praise, approval, reassurance, and so on, that are less skillful. They're more sticky and dependent. They've got a different flavour, don't they? I'm sure you know that in yourselves. And we'll grow out of these. Don't know how long it'll take, but we'll grow out of them. They're understandable, they're very human. And yet, if we were really evolved, we wouldn't be looking outside of ourselves. The Buddha didn't need the approval of other people. So full was his own self-acceptance. So yes, I'm just wanting to draw out that difference between praise, which has a sort of cloying effect, and appreciation, which feels very free, very beautiful, I would say. So this process I did leads to deeper self-metta and self-reliance. leads to a place where these winds don't rattle us. In the Mangala Sutta, the Buddha is asked, what is the highest blessing? And he describes successive levels of positive actions that bring blessings and good fortune to anybody. But he says the highest of all is the person whose mind does not shake or tremble when touched by the eight worldly winds, whose mind is steady, patient, and free of negativity. This is the greatest blessing of all. So the winds may blow, well, the winds will blow, but with practice, we'll be less and less shaken. We can keep an even keel with life's highs and lows. We can't affect the strength or the direction of the wind, but we can adjust our sails and modify our expectations. We can seek out the eye of the storm, where there's calm. Spiritual strength lies in meeting whatever happens with equanimity. And then we'll genuinely have found a still point in our turning world. Thank you.